Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again and welcome. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington, with the program that helps you learn American English. Today we have two stories for you. First, we're off to Paris to hear about a controversial new music hall that hopes to bring classical music to some people who normally could not afford the price of a ticket. Then we travel to Africa to hear about health problems and some wild animals. So if you're ready, let's listen and learn. The new Paris Philharmonic Concert Hall opened earlier this year. Long before opening day, people questioned the large amount of money required to pay for the building. Critics also were concerned about where it would be built, far from the center of the French capital. Now, the biggest problem is a social one. Can the concert hall influence a new generation of classical music lovers? Also, can it reach out to a working-class neighborhood? In the French language, the new Philharmonic Concert Hall on the edge of Paris is known as the Philharmonie de Paris. It is the home of the Paris Symphony Orchestra. Maybe, more importantly, it is a brave social experiment. President Laurent Bay says the aim is to sell classical music to young people, the poor, and a mix of ethnic and cultural groups.
Grosso modo, le modèle qu'on propose est un modèle.
The concert hall offers music that is usually linked to the city's pricey neighborhoods, where rich people live. But the Philharmonie is not located in the center of Paris. Instead, it is in an arts and science center in northeastern Paris called Parc de la Villette. Large meat processing centers operated on the grounds a century ago. Today, the park is a peaceful hideaway in an area filled with roads and working-class families. Rap and world music stars perform at La Villette. Now, the Philharmonie is bringing classical music to the park, too. President Laurent Bay says the goal is to reach a split in the Philharmonie's public between Paris and its suburbs. He says he does not expect to win over the poorest and the most difficult areas right away. The Philharmonie made news long before it officially opened. Building delays and money problems slowed work on the $417 million project. Today, critics wonder how it can succeed when other European fine arts centers are closing. But the Philharmonie is moving forward. Philippe Provençal is a spokesman. He takes visitors on tours of the building. They walk past an exhibit about pop music star David Bowie. There are also classrooms where people can learn to play any number of musical instruments. The cost of a class is only a few dollars per person. Mr. Provençal says the goal is simple. Music should be available to everyone in the best of conditions. It is not necessary to have years of training to play an instrument. On the building's top level, visitors can see a lot, not of Paris, but of the neighborhoods around it. To reach people in these areas, the concert hall keeps prices low on tickets for its performances. It also is setting up children's orchestras in ethnically mixed and poor neighborhoods. The goals of the Philharmonie may seem daunting, nearly impossible to reach, until you ask some young people what they think of it. Emeric Makwanza is from Shea, the kind of suburb that the Philharmonie is targeting.
C'est plutôt spécial, la forme arrondie, genre ça fait un peu électrique.
The young man says he has not yet gone into the building, but he thinks the architecture, its design, is special. He says he has heard classical music before, so why not go to a show at the Philharmonie? The heart of the Philharmonie is its concert hall. It looks like a large golden bowl with a theater in the middle. It seats 2,400 people. But the feeling is friendly. Every seat is a good one, so everyone can enjoy the shows. To date, the Philharmonie is enjoying sell-out performances. But as the newness slowly disappears, critics suggest traditional, wealthier theatergoers may think twice before traveling to this working-class neighborhood. President Laurent Baye disagrees. Other projects faced similar criticism. At the end, he says, they were successes. I'm Jim Tedder. The Ebola crisis in Sierra Leone has led to growing concern about another disease, rabies from wild dogs. Many owners fear their dogs could infect them with Ebola, so they have freed the animals. As a result, the stray dog population and number of rabies cases are increasing. Bob Doty has more.
Rabies is spreading in Sierra Leone. The country now has one of the largest stray dog populations in Africa. The situation has become worse during the Ebola crisis. Dr. Gudish Jallo is a veterinarian. In fact, he is one of the country's few trained experts on animal medicine. He also is a member of the Sierra Leone Animal Welfare Society. The group and local partners have launched a public information campaign on how to care for dogs in the time of Ebola. Dr. Jallo estimates there are about 500,000 stray dogs in Sierra Leone. That is double the number before Ebola became a health issue in West Africa. He says one reason for the increase is dog owners dying from Ebola. He says when owners die, other people do not want the dog because they fear it might infect them with the Ebola virus. Yet health officials in the United States have found that dogs can carry the virus but cannot infect people. That information comes from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Jallo has been traveling around Sierra Leone, telling people that they cannot get Ebola from dogs. He also says there is concern about rabies increasing with this overpopulation. For years, he has been giving free rabies vaccines to protect people from the disease. He also performs operations to keep the animals from reproducing. His efforts depend mainly on international financing. During the Ebola crisis, the rabies vaccine was not available in the country for several months because airline companies canceled flights to Sierra Leone. Only recently has he received a rabies vaccine.
What we really need to do now is to do humane dog population control, which will include vaccination, sterilization, and, where necessary, humane calling.
Mabinti Kamara works with the Freetown City Council, which is a partner in the campaign. Another goal is to reduce animal abuse by making sure communities understand the importance of dogs.
These animals are very useful to us. You know, at night, as we are having these thieves coming around, when these dogs are around, they will bark at them, so they're scared. So it's very, very important for us to take care of these animals.
Ms. Kamara says reaction from the communities has been good. She says most people are following the safety campaign's advice. Dr. Jallo says he will continue to do this kind of work because of his strong interest in animals. I'm Bob Doty.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Do you often start your day feeling tired? Do you ever fall asleep at work? Do you sometimes just feel out of it, as if your brain is still asleep even though your body is awake? If you answered yes to any of these questions, you might be suffering from what researchers call social jet lag. And help might come from simply changing your work hours. Till Roenberg is a German chronobiologist. Chrono comes from the Greek root word chronos and means time. So a chronobiologist is a scientist that studies the states of being awake and being asleep. Mr. Roenberg says that many people are working at times that don't match their body's natural sleep-wake cycle. This natural cycle is called the circadian rhythm. Mr. Roenberg says when your work schedule conflicts with your body's inner clock, it leads to extreme tiredness, similar to jet lag.
Meaning your body clock would give you the optimal window for sleeping, let's say, between midnight and 8 o'clock, or even later, that your social schedules would like you to fall asleep at 10 o'clock and get up at 6 o'clock because of work times, for example. And that discrepancy is very like a jet lag situation.
With jet lag, people feel extremely tired when they travel by air far distances. They end up in a place where the sleep-wake cycle is different from their own. Till Roenberg led researchers in a study at Ludwig Maximilian University in Munich, Germany. They studied social jet lag among workers at a steel company in Europe. Factory workers were given work times that matched their natural sleeping habits. Supervisors did not force the so-called night owls, people who like to stay awake at night, to get up early for work. On the other hand, supervisors also did not force early risers, sometimes called larks, to work late. Changing the schedules of the workers to fit their lifestyles improved their sense of well-being, says scientist Mr. Roenberg.
They sleep almost up to an hour longer on work days and therefore much shorter on their free days. And normally people have to catch up on their sleep loss on their work-free days, and we have shortened sleep on work-free days and lengthened the sleep on work days.
In other words, with the extra hour of sleep, workers reported feeling more rested. They also reported having small improvements in their general well-being. However, Mr. Roenberg says, the night owls did not report the same level of improvement. This suggests that nighttime work is hard on everyone. He adds that employees who wake up after better rest are more productive. The study was published in the journal Current Biology. I'm Anna Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The stock market crash of 1929 began a long and difficult period for the United States. President Herbert Hoover struggled to find solutions as the nation sank into the worst economic crisis in its history. But the Great Depression was not the only problem demanding answers from Hoover. The president also had to deal with a number of foreign policy issues. I'm Mario Ritter with Chris Cruz. This week in our series, we look at how the Great Depression affected relations between the United States and other countries.
My mother told me before she passed away, said, son, when I'm gone, don't forget to pray, 'cause there'll be hard times, hard times. Oh yeah, yeah. Who knows better than I?
There were revolutions in South America. Japan launched a campaign of aggression in northeastern China, and the economic situation in America created serious problems in relations with Europe. Hoover succeeded in some areas of his foreign policy, but he failed to solve America's economic troubles. And, like most Americans, he failed to recognize the importance of political changes taking place in Japan and Germany.
Herbert Hoover's foreign policy was marked by his desire to make friends and avoid war. Like most Americans, the new president had been shocked by World War I. Hoover had seen the results of that terrible war with his own eyes. He led the international effort to feed the many European victims of the fighting. The new president was also a Quaker, a member of the Religious Society of Friends. Quakers oppose war. Hoover shared the wish of most Americans that the world would never again fight a major war. To him, the bloody bodies at Verdun, the Marne, and the other battlefields of World War I showed the need to seek peace through negotiations.
Hoover worked toward this goal even before he entered the White House. Following his election, he had several months before becoming president. Hoover used this time to travel to Latin America for 10 weeks. He wanted to show Latin American nations that they could trust the United States to honor their rights as independent nations. Hoover kept his word. The year after he took office, his administration announced that it would recognize the governments of all Latin American countries, including governments that the United States did not like. Hoover told the American people that he would not follow the Latin American policies of President Theodore Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt decided in 1904 that the United States had a right to intervene in Latin America if it disagreed with the actions of governments there. Hoover said this was wrong. He told the country that it was more important to use friendship than to use force.
Hoover withdrew American forces from Nicaragua. He also arranged to withdraw them from Haiti. and he showed restraint as some 50 revolutions shook the nations of Latin America. Some revolutionary governments opposed the United States. They refused to pay debts to American companies, or they claimed ownership of foreign property. But Hoover refused to advance American interests by force. He wanted to prove that the United States could treat Latin American nations as equals. That policy was quite successful. Relations between the United States and Latin American countries generally improved under Herbert Hoover's leadership.
The situation in Europe was much more difficult and much more serious for the United States. The problem was simple: money. The Great Depression did not stop at America's borders. It moved to Britain, Europe, and beyond. And it brought extremely hard economic conditions. In Germany, the value of the national currency collapsed. Inflation forced people to buy goods with hundreds, thousands, even millions of German marks. They lost faith in the system, and they looked for some new leader to provide solutions. The economic crisis also put great pressure on the international circle of debt that had been created after the war. Suddenly, American bankers could no longer make loans to Germany. This meant that Germany could not pay back war debts to France and the other Allied nations in the War to End All Wars. And without this money, the Allied nations could not repay money that they owed American banks. The circle of debt fell apart.
Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
The situation grew worse and worse throughout the early months of 1930. Hoover finally had to announce that all nations could delay their debt payments to the United States for 1 year. Hoover's actions did what he wanted it to. It put a temporary stop to the international debt crisis. But it caused great damage to private banks. People lost faith in the banking system. Throughout Europe, people withdrew their money from banks. As a result, the European banks could not repay more than $1 billion that they had borrowed from private American banks.
This was not the only problem. Nations throughout Europe were also forced to take their currencies off the gold standard. This meant their money no longer could be exchanged for gold. The economic situation grew worse, and as it did, serious political tensions began to threaten peace in Asia and Europe.
The threat in Asia became clear first. Japan had defeated Russia in a war in 1905. This victory gave Japan control over the economy of the southern part of what was then called Manchuria in northeastern China. As years passed, Japan began to feel threatened by two forces. First, Chinese leader Chiang Kai-shek was trying to organize all of China under the control of his nationalist forces. Second, Russia was extending the Chinese Eastern Railway to the Russian port city of Vladivostok. Japan's army took control of the government in Tokyo in late 1931. The army was fearful of the growing threat to Japan's control of Manchuria, so it moved Japanese troops immediately into several Manchurian cities, and it claimed political control of the whole area. President Hoover and most Americans strongly opposed Japan's aggression, but they were not willing to take any action that might lead to another world war.
Japan's military leaders knew that the people of Europe and America had no desire to fight to protect China. And so the Japanese army marched on. It invaded the huge city of Shanghai, killing thousands of civilians. Western leaders condemned the action. American Secretary of State Henry Stimson said the United States would not recognize Japanese control in these areas of China. But again, Hoover refused to consider any economic actions against the Japanese, and he strongly opposed taking any military action. The League of Nations also refused to recognize Japan's takeover. It called Japan the aggressor in Manchuria. Japan reacted simply. It withdrew from the League of Nations.
Most Americans were not happy about Japan's aggression, but they were not willing to fight force with force. This was less true, however, for Secretary of State Stimson. Stimson was a follower of the old ideas of President Theodore Roosevelt. He believed a nation could only have a strong foreign policy by being strong and using its military power in times of crisis. But Stimson's voice was in the minority. Most Americans did not believe Japan really threatened the security of the United States, and they were not ready to risk their lives to help people in China. Opinions changed only after Japanese planes attacked the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, in December of 1941.
The same story was true in Europe, but France was worried about the rising power of the Nazis in Germany and the fascists in Italy and Spain. France proposed the creation of an international army. Hoover opposed that idea. He called for all nations to reduce their weapons. He believed that negotiation, not force, was the way to solve the problem. But the new leaders in Germany and Japan would listen much more closely to the footsteps of marching troops than to the high words of peace.
Our program was written by David Jarmel. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow our series on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Mario Ritter with Chris Cruz. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.